As Yuri just said, I work for Novell on the SUSE Linux high availability extension, which consists of a whole bunch of open source software packages, most of which came out of the Linux HA project. This is not a SUSE specific talk. All of this stuff is available on Fedora, Red Hat, CentOS, Debian, Ubuntu, etc. So there's three things to go through. What is high availability? Why might you care? Some things to think about if you're trying to build systems that have this particular property. And then kind of a whirlwind kind of high-level show and tell of what's come out of the Linux HA project over the last 10 years or so. So what is high availability? Leaning on Wikipedia, apparently it's a system design protocol and associated implementation that ensures a certain degree of operational continuity during a given measurement period. There's also a note on this article which says that it's too technical and difficult to understand and that somebody should revise it. Perhaps more usefully, a system is available if it's on and you can access it right now. It's highly available if it's on and you can access it all of the time, or at least if you think you can access it all of the time.
You charge for it that way.
You charge, yeah, exactly. People that care about this are air traffic control or enterprise data centers, mission critical stuff where lots of people depend on things either never being broken or only ever being broken for a very short amount of time. It's probably not terribly important if an individual's blog doesn't have this. People probably aren't going to die if your blog's offline for a day, but you hope.
Yeah, read my blog.
Except for Avi's blog. And you can measure the availability of a system. The availability is roughly the mean time to failure divided by the mean time to failure plus the mean time to repair. So the two things that you can do to increase the availability of a system is you can increase the mean time to failure by getting better hardware, or you can decrease the mean time to repair by deploying redundant hardware with some software to manage it. Hopefully you've got better hardware than this. But if you don't and you've got lots of it, maybe software can help. Seems to work for Google. The other thing is I lied about the presentation title. I do have 37 slides, but this isn't actually high availability in 37 easy steps because it's not something where you go through a series of steps and you get to the end and you go, "Hey, I'm highly available," and you walk away. And you know, that attitude only works until the system fails for a second time. And then you're screwed. So, to borrow a phrase from the security community, it's a process, not a product. It's something that you have to keep working on. And a good system administrator will actually give you better high availability than a poorly configured cluster ever will, as demonstrated here. So you're chuckling. So system design considerations, what do you look at when you're trying to build these things? It's very important to understand what exactly it is that you're trying to achieve. I'm going to be talking about having a couple of physical systems where they're providing some service or a web server, a database, a file system, whatever. And you want that to be up most or all of the time. But you need to know within what limits you're willing to operate. There's a web server that I look after there's no failover system. It's on reasonable hardware. It's in a good posting place. But it's been running for about 5 years. If it's ever been down, nobody's ever noticed. And this is completely fine. And if it died catastrophically, it would probably take me about a day to put it back together, get a new system commissioned, and install stuff, restore from backups, so on and so forth. This might be completely fine. So if you can get away with this, don't go for this HA failover stuff, because the added complexity, maybe it's not worth the trouble. And you do really want to keep it as simple as possible. There's all sorts of things you can do with cluster file systems, and the less stuff that you have to put in place, the better off you're going to be, because there's more things to go wrong. So this diagram, there's a group of people over there who'll be familiar with this. You've got a file server hooked up to a RAID, dual fiber channel, Ethernet talking to a client network. This is going to be reasonably highly available most of the time. Maybe it's fine. You've got a good system administrator, they've got some spare hardware somewhere, they can roll this stuff out and set something up again. So you've got redundant power connections to the server, redundant fiber connections to the storage. You're using a RAID, you can lose at least one disk, you can lose at least one fiber connection. You can lose half power in the building, and something's still going to work. But the server itself can still implode or catch fire or something, and the software could still die horribly. So you can deploy instead something like this, where you have two identical servers talking to each other over a private network. The simplest way to do this is with an active-passive configuration. So one of the two nodes is serving the files, the other one's sitting there doing almost nothing until the first one dies, and then it will take over. This obviously adds some amount of complexity and cost to the picture. It becomes more complex. There's more connections. There's software that's got to be running to monitor all of this stuff. And in a two-node cluster, particularly if you've got shared storage, if those two nodes get confused about who's in charge and they both start writing to the storage at the same time, life isn't very good. So Stonoth to the rescue, which stands for shoot the other node in the head, you end up with hardware that looks a little bit like that. Hopefully without guns. Usually there's a power switch that they both talk to. Well, this would be more fun.
Thermite.
Sorry?
Thermite
would be good.
Yeah, but they're wrapped above each other, so you shoot the top node.
Well, hopefully that one fails first. That's actually not a bad idea, though. there's a point here. Two-node clusters can be problematic, so often what Stonoff will do is it'll reset one node and then it'll come up and it'll once see the other one and it'll reset the second one and they shoot each other forever and it's less available than it would be ordinarily.
Thermite's a good idea.
So don't set the Stonoff action to reset, because you'll end up in these strange cycles and it's horrible. Set it to power off, make sure that you notice when one of the nodes goes down, and then a human can come in and bring the other one up nicely so that it doesn't get angry. Or get a third node. Sorry?
Put a randomized delay in the shutdown script, or at least different delays.
Different delays in the shutdown script. Get a third node, or get any odd number of nodes, because then you can rely on quorum if less than half the nodes in the cluster, if that's all they can see, they're not going to do anything. More than half the nodes in the cluster are going to play nice together, and the other one will just sit down and shut up, more or less. The final thing there is, you really want to test it. Deploy a test cluster, make sure it works, see how it's going to fail, put a whole lot of load on it, work out where the edges are, because once you're in production, it's going to fail, and whether you're willing to accept that failure or not. So it's really, really important to have test cluster that you can play around with before going into deployment. So with that, we're onto HA clustering software. As I mentioned before, I'm specifically going to be talking about software that's come out of the Linux HA project over the last 10 years or so. There is commercial HA clustering software around. There's Veritas, Oracle, I imagine has several.
Now even more.
Cool. I will briefly mention Red Hat Cluster Suite later, but it's basically Linux HA stuff. So in the beginning, there was Heartbeat version 1, which was easy to configure because it couldn't do anything. This configuration here says that we've got an IP address and a file system that are both going to get started up together. And we'd really like them to run on node 1, please. But that's all it could do. You had two nodes, and you couldn't monitor individual resources for failure. You couldn't have, say, a database and a file system over here. If the database dies, maybe you want to keep the file system running for some other purpose. You couldn't do that. So then came Heartbeat version 2 with a new cluster resource manager. It does support more than two nodes. It can monitor individual resources. You can set up all sorts of interesting and strange complex dependencies between resources if you feel like it. A resource here, I should be declaring my terminology, a resource here is a service that you want to make highly available. It's an NFS server, or it's a file system, or it's an IP address, or whatever. But with all that flexibility, it got a little bit trickier to configure. And going through all of that XML, it hurts your eyes sometimes. Somebody on the Sage AU list sometime last year was lamenting the complexity of this. And somebody else said, no, it's not overly complex, it's certifiably fucking insane. which I don't necessarily disagree with, but it is actually necessary. So, meanwhile, Heartbeat got split into two separate projects around about when Heartbeat 2.1.4 appeared. What was called Heartbeat became only the membership and messaging layer, that is the piece of software that knew whether nodes were up and could send messages between them, but had no idea what all was running on top of them. And the other part was the cluster resource manager, which moves all your resources around and decides where they're going to run. That became called Pacemaker. There were various reasons for this split. One of them was to decouple the release cycles of the two projects. Another one was so that Pacemaker could support alternate messaging infrastructure underneath, adding support for OpenAIS, which in turn is necessary if you want to use the distributed lock manager and thus GFS2 or ICFS2. This whole software stack now looks something like this. You've got your messaging layer down the bottom. There's Pacemaker is everything from here up, except for that bit. So you can choose either one of these messaging layers, and Pacemaker sits on top managing all your resources. To further add to the confusion, most recently OpenAIS split itself into two pieces because the developers realized that after spending 5 years trying to develop APIs that fit the service availability forum specifications, that it was really hard just to do basic clustering. So that got split off into its own project, Chorusync, to recognize the need for a focusing on that, and OpenAIS became some plugins, which is what you need for DLM, ICFS2, some of the bits and pieces. So finally, now we've got, you can either run Pacemaker version 1 on top of Heartbeat version 3, or you can run it on top of Chorusync and maybe OpenAIS if you need the clustered file system magic. And you end up with a software stack that looks like this. Yeah.
Pacemaker
does pacemaker support the DRM that ships with ACFS2? If you're talking about the O2CB thing, then no, it's using the user space DRM. So, interesting side point. If you would like to buy SUSE Linux Enterprise Server with the high availability extension, they do pay my salary. And unfortunately, they don't. They'll support OCFS2 either with the O2CB stack by itself for Oracle Rack deployments or the user space stack with Pacemaker for any other use. So that's the split there.
Also, that's a good dropping
OCFS2
back.
Back
now, no longer by.
Cool, I hope it still lasts. So, file system stuff in the kernel. Over on the right, that's YAST plugin modules for configuring various bits and pieces. You only get that on SUSE. All that stuff in the middle is the HA stack that I'm talking about. So there's your messaging layer. On top of that, there's Pacemaker. There's some management tools. These orange things down the side are a subset of the resource agents that are available for managing various things like, oh, you can see them there. Oh, actually, maybe you can't see them there. Can you see them there?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So now here we are with Pacemaker 1.1-ish, actually. And it's actually easy to configure again, thanks to the CRM shell. This is the equivalent of that Heartbeat version 1 configuration from before. There's an IP address which has a certain value we're monitoring it every 5 minutes. There's a file system, we're mounting it on data 1, it's ext3. The IP address and file system are grouped together so that the IP address starts up and the file system starts up. They must both be on the same node, wherever that is. And we'd really, really like them to be running on node 1, please. And so with all of that, it's also a lot more flexible now than it was before. Here is an example of three nodes. They're all talking the same storage backend, clustered file system on top, and you're moving virtual machine instances around from node to node, and there's a LAMP Apache thingy there. This sort of thing actually gets really interesting with virtual machines. I should mention that says Xen there, but it'll work with Xen or KVM or people have done stuff with VMware too. If you've deployed, if you used to have half a dozen physical systems and you use virtualization to consolidate all that on one physical system, then your risk is much greater. If that one system goes down, you've lost six systems worth of service. So instead, maybe what you should do is deploy a couple of failover systems, either one of which itself can handle the full load of all of those VMs, but most of the time they'll be sitting balanced between the two nodes. If one of them dies, all your services keep going. So that's good. There are also some useful tools. It's going to break, right? Excuse me. The whole reason we're doing this is so that we can deal with things failing and then having something that can pick up from them quickly. So the CRM shell includes the ability to see what's going to happen if something that's running fails. The SIB there, that's the cluster information base, that's where the configuration for the cluster is stored. So you start up the CRM shell, you create a new copy of the SIB, you load all the status information into it, and then you tell it that one of the monitor operations that was running on the IP address has returned not running to indicate that IP address is dead. Run this ptest command, it tells you that this fake simulated cluster has noticed that the monitor operation has failed. And then it'll draw you this pretty little graph. This is what the cluster would do in that circumstance. The orange text are virtual operations that kind of make it simpler to visualize. The first thing it's going to do is it's going to stop the file system because the IP address and the file system are located together. You may not want this, so this can be a really good tool for figuring out whether you've configured your cluster correctly at all. If the IP address goes down, you probably don't want to have to unmount and remount the file system just so the IP address can restart. So maybe you should swap those around. So this tells you what the cluster would do though. It stops the file system, it stops the IP address, everything's then stopped. It tries to start the IP address again on the same node that it was on, and then it goes and monitors it. And after that, it starts the file system up, begins monitoring the file system again, and then everything's running. These can get quite huge if you have many resources and you simulate a node failure, all sorts of things stop and move around, but it's a very, very valuable tool. The other thing, after it breaks, HP report provided all of your nodes in your cluster can SSH to each other. If you run this, it will collect up all of the log files from all the nodes in the cluster, what software you've got installed, the output of PS, so you can see what processes are running on each cluster, architecture, a history of all of the things that the cluster has done recently. It'll parse core dumps for you and give you backtraces, so you can go and hassle software developers and tell them the software's crap. You need the debug info packages installed for that to work, and core dumps need to be turned on. All this stuff ends up in a single tarball, and you can go and look through that later. It's fairly verbose. You've obviously looked at one.
I've read it.
But you can actually, after correlating a bunch of log files together and using that same p-test tool from previously, you can get graphs up of what the cluster was going to do then, or actually what it did do. And you can work out exactly what went wrong. And this is really important on production systems in particular, because faults with this sort of stuff are, particularly intermittent ones, are incredibly hard to reproduce. And even if you could reproduce them, you don't want them on a production system, because then your users are going to be down for even longer than they were before.
Yeah. Did it combine log files?
Does it combine log files into time order? A subset of them, yes. There's a file in there, events, something or other, and you can actually you can see alternating nodes with interesting things that have happened. That's the first place to look. It'll also give you and that's where it will give you a little bit of summary about core dump, seek fault, and that sort of stuff's happened too.
Does it assume that the machines are in clocks are in sync when it does that?
Does it assume the clocks are in sync? I don't know, and I'm going to have to guess that it might not, because I've been through the output of this on two systems whose clocks were out of sync by about 30 seconds, and it was a little bit weird. Not necessarily. Actually, it's the... don't quote me on this. I believe that Corasync doesn't actually care. The protocol imposes a total order on the messages that it sends around. So if the clocks are out of sync, I don't think it breaks. But it is recommended that all of the systems, of course, be synced with NTP. Okay, so that's kind of my high-level whirlwind tour. There's a very active developer and user community around all of this software. The Linux HA and Linux cluster channels on Freenode, various mailing lists. There's a lot of really good documentation now, finally. There's at least two versions of a book, Clusters from Scratch, that talk about setting up highly available file servers using GFS and OCPS2. Linbit, who made DRBD, which is a network RAID 1 kind of thing, have wonderful documentation on how to set all of that up. A guy from the Netherlands whose first name is Sander and whose last name I can't pronounce. Bingo. Where did that come from? That was you. he recently announced a book, Practical Zen High Availability with SLES. the principles therein should be equally applicable to KVM if you want to look at that. That's well worth a look. It's a you pay for a copy and actually you'll get updates, but there's also one floating around on one of the mailing lists somewhere if you can find it. The community is very helpful, moderately friendly, and unless you obviously haven't read any of the documentation, then there might be a little bit of sarcasm, but they really are all very nice. My brief mention of Red Hat Cluster Suite is to point out that both SUSE and Red Hat are kind of converging on the same set of software for their cluster stack. So previously SUSE had the Heartbeat messaging layer, Red Hat Cluster Suite was using Chorus Anchor OpenIIS. Now everybody's using Chorus Anchor OpenIIS. Sorry? Okay. Yeah. So Chorus Sync and OpenIIS was only relatively recent for Red Hat, was that? The other thing is Pacemaker is being proposed as a replacement for RG Manager. This wafted past in very small text in a mailing list post fairly recently. Red Hat don't say what's coming up, and I certainly can't because I wouldn't even know, but that did go past on the mailing list. If you look at the RG Manager wiki page, right down the bottom, there's a link, a broken link, to the installation docs for Pacemaker, which mentions it's a proposed replacement. So if you're already using the Red Hat stuff, it's worth looking at this a bit. The other thing is that Heartbeat now is effectively in maintenance mode. After the 3.0 release, there's no more active development being done on it. The guys from Linbit who made DRBD have taken stewardship of the project and they're still accepting patches and things and bugs will be fixed. If you're using this, they will give you commercial support if you want to pay somebody for it. And right now, Pacemaker still works perfectly on top of both stacks, but it's expected that this sort of line of development is fading away. This is actually why I went through all of that big long history with all the project splits and all over the place, because I still think that there's people get on the IRC channels or the mailing list and say, oh, hey, I want to do this HA thing, talk to me about Heartbeat, and then they get completely bewildered by this stream of things that have changed and what's supported and what's not. So if you do go looking at this stuff, hopefully that overview of where things have been is useful. Is it highly available enough? The German air traffic control people are actually using this stuff. So if you've flown in Europe any time in the last few years, you've already relied on it. They use their radar, they've built their radar system on top of this. It used to be a proprietary Unix thing, and they replaced it with... they're probably using Heartbeat 2 still, actually. But anyway, so it is actually being used out there in the real world. And with that, now that my throat is completely dry... questions and answers. If anybody has any, I hopefully have answers. Yes, Julian?
So, how do you explain to non-operations type people when a vendor says this is HA, in this case actually, a vendor says this is HA, this Heartbeat is this, except the failover may take 10 minutes or more and would actually be required to be run nightly anyway. How do you explain to them, because they obviously don't understand 9 terminology?
I'm not sure I've got a good answer for that. Although
dollars per transaction.
Reduce it to dollars and lots.
This probably doesn't answer your question, but there's an interesting paper down the bottom of the Wikipedia HA page, which is entitled The Myth of the Nines, and about where that five nines business came. Some very wrong assumptions in a particular part of the telecommunications industry, and then And then everybody else ate it up in marketing speech. Apparently, like, you'll see five nines in marketing literature, but if you're actually building one of these systems, you're more likely to talk about the probability that it is that it's going to fail, not...
We talk from the banking point of view, we talk of the cost of a loss transaction.
Yep.
So from a banking perspective, we get a maximum only because if we lose 30 minutes worth of transactions, that for a tier one bank is upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on what time you're talking about.
Yeah. The other thing is, if it has to fail over every night, there's something wrong.
Don't buy software from Yahoo.
Okay.
This stuff looks, and this could just be an ignorance, but is this primarily geared towards active, passive style customers, or does it also support active, active?
It also supports active, active. That's fairly boring. Here's some links as well, and if anybody's interested. It does support active, active. Pacemaker itself doesn't care what resources you're actually running. They're started up by these resource agent scripts, which are they're kind of like init scripts, but you can pass parameters to them, and there's a little bit more rigor in the semantics. So you can if you use Pacemaker with OCFS2, for instance, you've got a clustered file system which is active on all of the nodes. You can, if you're really lucky, you can run NFS daemons on all those nodes on top of that. I'm being a bit cheeky by saying lucky, sorry.
But you're on the NFS side, that's fine.
This stuff won't make a broken service any more available. Right. If your underlying thing that you're trying to make highly available can't run for a long time, this isn't going to help. It's just going to notice quicker, and then things will be deader sooner. And that's really good for reporting bugs to other people, but this is why test. Yep.
Yeah, if I can just say, we've had a half day system for several years, very successful. It's failed over a couple of months. You get into issues with the SSL key, stuff like that, because your IP address.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, the IP address is the same. If you're at the site, all of a sudden it's an intruder or something going on. Why is this? And then you go,
Yeah.
It's the second machine cut in. And the other benefit from that is that for maintenance, that you just take the slave down, you do your maintenance, you check that it works, and then you bring it back up.
Yeah. With a Leatherman, he propped it on the keyboard to press the yes key when the file system check was going through.
Yeah. Another strategy I know a lot of people do is not so much have automated HA failover software, but instead just have a good monitoring system that messages them when something goes down and then rely on the human to make a decision about shooting the right thing in the head and going ahead, which actually I know very, very, very big things work.
That's a terrible idea.
It does mean it.
You publish them as app.
That's a really good point. All of this stuff is an excellent solution for a particular class of problems, but it's not a good solution for every problem, and it's a particularly bad solution for some problems.
Especially if the resource becoming highly available does not make it easy to do so automatically.
Yeah.
It can be useful having a human check it, so you don't just say, split your replication.
Yeah. Your customer, the customer comes from the Oracle world, used to people say, oh, no, that's some shit. I think I've got to, we sat down and said, right, what do you want to do for disaster recovery? And of course, I'm thinking they want, 10 minutes. How long can you be down without recovery? How about a week? You are previously up to the
time.
And this is from their HR system. So, what about payroll? Oh, we'll just run last week and fix it up there. Sorted, you're very cheap.
If we lost our primary data center in Melbourne, in ruin.
Yeah,
really going to worry.
The other fun one is don't check too often.
Yes.
Another certain large internet company had sub-second fail over time. Turns out they hadn't counted on leap seconds.
Make sure the people who do the day-to-day work know what a cluster is. Because
yes.
It's really impacting of two nodes. One has been upgraded, the other one hasn't. And
yes.
Failed conversion of the software. Particularly in things like file system drives being updated, and it fails over, and you can't mount the file
system. Can't mount the file system. Yep.
That
would never happen.
No software takes away from user mistakes.
Yeah.
Such as, we'll just shut it all down and upgrade everything. Availability.
There's a lot to be said for keeping something resembling an operations manual somewhere that's legible in the warehouse.
And people follow it.
Yeah.
And once you get this kind of information, having a test grid with it is almost critical.
Yes, absolutely.
Can
someone please find it
Yuri's standing up, so I think I've got to go.
One more question?
Anybody?
One last question. Make it a good one.
Can we get your slides anyway?
Not yet, but I'll put them somewhere, and I'll link to them off the Love Wiki page for this talk.
Thank you.
That works. Cool. Thank you.